Auckland Grey Power is pleased to sponsor this edition of Senior Focus. Welcome, everyone, to this edition of Senior Focus. I'm Anne-Marie Khoury. I'm your presenter today. And I have in the studio with me two guests, both of whom are women standing for the first time in local body elections. And they are standing in the Auckland region, one for a councillor role and the other for a local board role. I thought it was a good contrast. So welcome to Jessamine Fraser and Alex Bonham.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Right. So I'm going to start with Jessamine first. And in this election, we have 20 councillor roles across the city. So, Jessamine, which area are you standing in?
I'm standing for the Faux Ward.
Right. And can you tell us a little bit about your background and what skills you are going to bring into council? I understand that you've got a passion about housing and that you're an architect and you have a practice, but maybe you'd like to elaborate on that.
Sure, thanks. So I'm a New Zealand registered architect and I also teach at Unitech School of Architecture at the first year level for the design students. And one of the things that I'm hoping to bring to this process of council and the whole political trying to make things happen is that the design process is fundamentally about context, it's fundamentally about people, it's about relationships and how we relate to each other, how we relate to our environment, which is also what politics is about. I've been involved in the Green Party since 2014, and I've been involved in policy for the Green Party. So I'm quite familiar with how those two things kind of intersect. And one of the things that I don't see happening a lot in politics is the kind of the joined up thinking between how when we do X, it affects Y and so on, and how we need to make all those things work together at the same time. So as you said, Anne-Marie, one of my key things that I'm really interested in about is equitable housing. So that's income-linked housing, it's sustainable housing, it's housing that's linked into our communities and helps take us all forward further.
Mm. And indeed, that interests me too, because housing's been one of my passions from before I got on the board, but I am on a local board now. And for the purposes of this is not an election ad, but I have to say that I am a candidate standing for the Pukitapapa local board. It's important that I do that. And also the policies we're going to be talking about, they're, because we share something in common, they're policies that are linked between Labor, Greens and community independence. So I sit at that far end of the continuum. I'm a community independent. I don't wear a party jacket. However, in terms of joined upness, I totally agree that that is one of the issues that people often are thinking gets very siloized, and I think that Auckland Council as a large bureaucracy is in danger of practices that lead to intense siloization, and you don't get the best outcomes if you are locked in a tunnel and you're not sharing information across the top of the silo. And that's one of the problems that I think it's fair enough to say there has been, and the executive at council has been working to try and overcome that, but it's not easy. It's structural and it does require setting up multidisciplinary teams, multi-department teams, in order to get the flow, and I don't think that's really happened enough.
It does require multidisciplinary teams. It also does require someone who's guiding those teams and building the relationships between those teams, because you do need experts. You know, so if you look at the design of a building, you're going to have a bunch of different experts in structural engineering, electrical engineering, fire engineering. You're going to have a town planner. You're going to have a whole raft of people who are involved in the process. And then they've all got to focus on their specific bit, which is what the architect is for, really, is that we bring the whole thing in together. So we have the design vision, and we bring all those strands of their expertise in together so that they work together to a cohesive whole. So it's quite a complicated process, and that's where I think the politicians should be coming in, is actually taking on that role of helping the experts in council come together to create a cohesive solution.
Yes, and I think the culture of the staff are seen as the advisors, and they advise the politicians, is almost a reverse of what you've just said, in a way. And that's one of the areas that's concerned me in the last 3 years. It's been quite difficult sometimes to interrupt the conversation and say, well, look, that's all very well, you're telling us all this, but let's go up to 10,000 feet and say, what do we need for the next 10 years? Have you considered this, this and this? And they're not used to that at all, from my experience.
Yeah, I think what you need is to be able to understand where they're coming from their level of expertise, and understand enough about their expertise, their area, to be able to challenge them to take that expertise further. Not to do something that contradicts their expertise, but to push it further, to push it harder.
And we have another guest with us. I'd like to introduce to you Mark Graham, who is also standing for council, and he's standing for a councillor role in the Albert Eden Puketapa Ward. Welcome, Mark.
Good morning. How are we?
Great. So nice to have you, three of you, in the studio. And we've been hearing from Jessamyn Fraser talking about the role, as she sees it, of the politician at council in terms of influencing outcomes. And I like the statement where we might be focused on X, but have we really looked at what's going to happen and what the outcome's going to be and what it's going to be like to have Y turn up? And that's not always the case. People don't always see what the end result might be, and so they can start with something. Also with council, decisions come along that are quite long in the tooth. They might have been decided by a legacy council some years and years back, and there may be some vested interests have come into that decision. Those interests have shifted, and also the needs of the population have shifted. So we're grappling with Liston Village at the moment, and that's a very big issue, but it's centred around decisions that were made by legacy council. Now we have a housing shortage. Demolishing the village does not seem like a very good idea. And so the board has grappled with this and come up with a win-win. And those of you who are following the issue will know more about it. I'm not going to talk about it now, but it's the sort of challenges that come up at council, that you inherit a lot of stuff, and the times have changed, the needs have changed, and you need to revisit some things, but you don't always have the freedom to revisit everything that you'd like to revisit.
I think that brings up an interesting issue, and that is that some projects get to have an inertia of their own. So there is an inability, I think, in many situations to go back and review decisions that were made some time before. And I think that's an unfortunate thing, and people get locked into positions that maybe in retrospect may not be the best thing, but because there's kind of a momentum that the project gathers, it's very hard to go back and change that. I don't really know how you address that unless, you know, it comes from the top, you know, with the people who are actually in charge who are willing to actually reconsider things and admit that maybe the course of action that was decided on before is wrong. And that's quite a hard thing for people to do.
Yes, and I think that this issue was part of the local government conference this year, where they were trying to get people to focus more on community and more on immediate needs and be less locked into business as usual, which is that momentum that you're talking about that can be feel very slow and pedantic and unresponsive. And so there were a number of people at that conference who were provocateurs. Sorry, thank you, Mark. And there were people who were deliberate disruptors there. But Dame Tariana Turia kicked it off by saying, everything's got to change. Things have to change. We just can't keep going the way we're going. And I think that there's a lot of fresh people coming on board in this election, people putting themselves forward. That really excites me, that we've got this new energy coming. So I'd like to ask you, Alex, about why you're standing and what's motivated you to put yourself forward. You're coming onto a local board, and local boards are not at the governing body table. So there is a bit of tension there, and there's not always the same capacity of influencing things quite as widespread as someone sitting at the governing table. How do you see coming onto the board, and how do you see your background? You've got quite a focus in terms of children and play and responsible design, and how does the structures that we present in the community, how does that help children's development? So yeah.
So you've mentioned the play. I'm doing a PhD on play and the city, but it's not entirely about children. There was this great book by Paul M. Friedberg in 1970, and he made the very good point that it's people who are children, but also people who are retiring, who need more connections, more walkable links, more activities, and more chance to spend time with each other and have a purpose. He says there's something a bit counterintuitive about play with older people, that for older people, often work was play. And funnily enough, actually, that's the same thing with children. Actually, Charlie, my little boy who's 8, I mean, he'll be working on his Lego, and he will be working as studiously as an engineer. So, I mean, it's play, but for him, it's an incredibly important project. So it's really important for all of us. And when you start thinking of the city as being for play, the exchange of ideas, those social connections, those projects that we do together, I think that gets the heart of really what the city is for and why so many of us live in the city. It's not just about being available for a job. That's part of it. But it's also the chance to be who we want to be. And that is very connected with our whole life, to go back to the holistic idea, our whole life, not just the labour that we can offer.
Mm. That's really exciting, because I've written on play, the Takaro document that the council produced. I had an input into that, and I had similar ideas, particularly having been to see some of the playgrounds in Melbourne and Sydney and some of the playgrounds in Wellington, just because they acknowledge the adults need to play. And so in our board area, we have the first Māori playground, traditional Māori playground, Te Mara Hupara. And that playground allows adults to test out their balance skills on logs. It didn't cost anything near what a normal playground costs.
And it's lovely.
It's lovely. And kids just adore it. They just can't get enough of it. So that'll be something that's coming up in Placemaking Week. There'll be a specialist in Māori games coming and actually conducting sessions during the day for the intermediate age kids. It's going to be really cool.
Yeah.
So there's lots of ways that we're using it. I know that the council may even look at doing team building there. Cassie Casey suggested it to the mayor, and I think that may be part of what the senior exec do in the new year.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's great having a focus on play that is more challenging for older kids, but throughout, I mean, play becomes something that is just within your reach, really. It's that sort of edge of the possible. So, I mean, 10-year-olds would balk at doing things that 5-year-olds might do until they find the way that it challenges them to become stronger and braver and more creative, or whatever, you know, it is. And that carries on the whole way through life. It's just that when you're grown up, you call it skiing, or you call it
dancing.
Going to the track, or you call it dancing. Yeah.
You know, there's a thing that's kicked off up in K Road at a nightclub, which is 6 a.m. dance club. So you go in, and it's exercise instead of going to the gym, but you go and dance for an hour.
Yeah.
Get sweaty and then go home and have breakfast. How brilliant.
It's brilliant.
Yeah.
That's what we need.
Yeah.
We were also just, Alex and I were talking just before about some research that my father introduced me to just last night from, so it's Dutch research, that shows a really strong link between adult depression and a lack of good quality open spaces. And the quality of your urban environment has a really strong link with your mental health.
Yeah.
So getting these sorts of things, so getting play spaces, getting green spaces, getting community spaces is a really important part of ensuring that we have a healthy, happy community.
Mm. And there's another aspect to this too, and that is removing some of the barriers, like lack of transport or... we were talking earlier about problems with visual disturbance and people who have low vision tripping on curbs and things, because the built environment has to be accessible. It's got to be actually laid out suitable for everybody. And we've got 25% of people now needing accessible environments.
Well, and can I also add hearing as well, noise?
Yes.
You know, somebody who's hearing impaired. I was at a presentation the other night by the Auckland, it's an Auckland Office of Design, AOD, ADO, Auckland Design Office.
Yep.
And it was at the Ellen Melville Centre, which is fantastic, but they had the aircon on and it was really noisy. And, I was struggling to hear, but the tension in the room elevated because people were not able to hear the speakers properly. They weren't mic'd up. And it contributed at the end, I think, to a feeling of tension and a little bit of the confrontation that ended up coming through. So it was quite interesting. And that impacts on our daily lives as well. And, hearing loss actually shows that has been shown to increase your chances of Alzheimer's. Certainly isolation, because you can't hear people speak, so you retreat. And so noise pollution is really bad as well, and that interferes in our enjoyment of spaces too. Mm. Mm. I mean, more than me would be aware of that.
Yes. So
just to throw that at you. Yeah,
spot,
yeah.
Well, I was thinking that because I'm a LifeMark partner, for those of you who are not aware of what LifeMark is, LifeMark is a certification scheme for housing. So if you're designing housing, you go through a certification process with LifeMark to get a tick off that it's an accessible house, right?
So it's things like wider corridors,
in case wider
you
doors.
Need to fit in wheelchairs and stuff.
Yep,
where
the power points are on the wall, so you don't have to bend down too low. And I think these are the sorts of things that we could also have the same sort of set of criteria, or obviously a different set of criteria, but the same ethos behind the criteria when we're thinking about how we design public spaces.
Mm.
Because at the moment we design public spaces for able-bodied people, and then we go, oh, now we need to deal with some accessible aspects.
Well, this is the whole
put in a ramp.
This is the whole A for E that's coming in around the city, right, which is access for all. Access for everyone, but it was interesting, and bringing it back to home, the Mount Albert Town Centre upgrade that happened recently, and I've been taking an interest in that because that's in the ward here, and looking at how that came to its final implementation, and looking at some of the impediments to it being a successful space. And the number one thing obviously is that it's a town centre that's split into four quadrants by two main arterial routes. So you get, noise and fumes and a physical block of traffic coming through, steel, big two-ton steel cages coming through. And so right off from the start, you've got problems around the actual space itself. Not to mention that it's on a slope. And as the space and the township has gone through a bit of a fallback in terms of patronage, shops have shut down, and that creates this whole space of urban decay and not very nice place to be. And so trying to bring that back is actually really difficult, especially given the circumstances that you're working with around there.
Mm. Well, I think there's a lot of things that we can do to bring that back. One of the things that we do is we tend to look at is we tend to look at how do we, because it's the easy thing in some respects, is how do we change the landscaping, how do we change the urban scape of the area? Where do we put the bus stops? Can we narrow the road at this point, divert the heavy traffic? And all of that's really important. But I think there's also a question in here when we're talking about urban renewal and trying to do it in an equitable way, so ensuring that the existing local community is part of that urban renewal rather than ending up having to move further and further out. One of the things that I would be quite interested in is looking at whether or not there is scope for essentially affordable retail tenancies, affordable workshop spaces, so that if you're starting up a small business, you can have a high street presence. You don't have to be a big international brand to be on the high street.
A micro retail policy, I think they had around the central city as well. So there's loads of really tiny eateries and some small shops. And it means that you've got this huge diversity, and it's a way of starting out.
That's the exact strategy that Peter Cooper and the Britomart company did. Where that Britomart area, you know, they had these old buildings that had no lifts and, you know, had a minimal amount of functionality, but they were cool old buildings, and they rented them out at peppercorn, leased them out at peppercorn rentals to attract creative agencies, software startups, and so forth. And so these companies actually came into these buildings, populated the area, which meant that there was a set market for the eateries and the bars that went in. Right? And so you got this positive kind of feedback loop happening with people there, places for them to go, and the area became cool. And now they're slowly going through and doing up all the buildings and making it more expensive, which is what happens with gentrification, right? But still, you know, that's what kickstarts these things. And
yeah, but I suppose what I'm just picking up on your mention of gentrification, one of the things we need to do if we want to avoid gentrification, because one of the things about gentrification is it actually it continues as a wave, and it goes across the suburbs further and further out.
Drives the poor and the artists and the students and the old out, right?
Further and further away, which is a problem. So obviously we want to stop that. And one of the ways that we stop that is by having structures in place, not just relying on the goodwill of a developer who's got a longer term game where they're going to up the rents at a later date, but you actually build this in. You say, we're going to have 10% of the shops in this area are always going to be affordably rented. And that's going to be, you know, maybe they get owned by the council or a local organisation or something, but you actually start to put that in place so that local businesses will always have that opportunity. Because you look at somewhere like Newmarket, where the whole of Newmarket is owned by a mall company. So they've all got all the same shops that are in the malls are in the street. So you've got no scope really for anyone new to come into that space.
There are some, but it's high risk. I mean, Arcadia, the bookshop.
Yes.
And the Poi Room, you know, and around Ted Street, there's a couple of great cafes. So, I mean, I hear what you say, but you tend to see that in a retail environment almost all around the world, don't you?
Yes.
You know, you go to New York and the Gap is on every second corner.
Yeah.
Alternating with Banana Republic and you know.
So what's the point as a tourist of going shopping somewhere?
Yeah, exactly.
And you're right. And it's the same with housing as well. Like, one of the issues for some older seniors in my area is that they moved into a very affordable villa in the 1970s, and as time has gone on, it's become an incredibly expensive villa, but it's their home and it's their garden. They've been cultivating for 30 years, but the rates have become incredibly high. So there, I think that there might have to be some sort of conversation so that it's really, so that there is definitely enough housing for all stages in life in the neighbourhood, because you can argue that that family villa really needs to be lived in by a new family because it's big. It might just be one person living in. But it's hard enough to leave your own home. But if you have to leave your neighbourhood and all of your local social connections, that is brutal, which is why it's so important to have really good senior housing everywhere. Like you should have primary schools everywhere, and then those sort of neighbourhood connections, that mycelium under the soil sort of connections.
Yes. Well, there's examples from overseas of where they've got student accommodation mixed in with senior accommodation, which means that they both groups benefit from interacting with each other. They get those support networks.
Yeah, we are kind of heading off on a tangent here, which is I love it. It's very interesting, but it's kind of the field that we work in collectively, I guess. You know, I publish in architecture. Jasmine's an architect, and of course Alex is around that urban play space, right? Mm-hmm. So this is kind of a focus for us. So we could tend to keep going down this path if you want it.
Well, it's very interesting because I did see that there was a definite connection that you would all have, and I thought this was a way to have an exciting program.
Yeah, you want
to
keep going with
and
this?
So I'm happy to keep going because in fact what you've touched on, all of you, is the many of the nitty-gritty issues about how does the city stay livable while it intensifies and how does it stay home for the seniors who've been here for a long time.
Going back to your questionnaire that you sent us about, you know, why we're running, you know, one of the important things for me is around shaping the future of the city and how the city develops. So, you know, we're seeing with the UP coming in.
Yes, I'm listening.
With the UP coming in and intensification happening, with new transport modes coming through, but also with climate change that is going to be impacting us, how we live is going to change quite dramatically, I think. And our suburbs are going to have to change. It's not just an urban environment that's going to change. It is the suburban environment that is going to change. And now, I live in Point Chef, so... You know, in some respects, it's a city fringe suburb, but in other respects, it could be Henderson. So, what's going to happen there? You know, we're going to see multi-unit developments, and they're starting already. We're going to see local shops becoming more important, I think, and that's going to be the saviour, I think, of local retail, because you're not wanting, or you won't be able to, just jump in your car and zing off 5 kilometres to a supermarket or 3 kilometres up the road. You'll want to go to the local butcher and the local bread shop.
Well, what you need to make this work, and it comes back also to what Alex was saying about play and having play spaces, is we actually need more master planning that's driven by the council rather than saying, well, we'll earmark this area for development and then... Just put it out there for developers to do their thing.
Yeah.
Like, we actually need some built-in master planning that says this is how we want this to work.
And councils have done it before. I mean, in Vancouver, you know, they had really strict rules. About 30% of houses and development had to be for families. There had to be units that were affordable. There had to be places for seniors. And as a result, they worked really well.
Borneo Wharves in Amsterdam is a really good example of some really clear master planning.
So it's very interesting that, you know, touching on the development of the city, urban landscapes, and the importance of having families in there, because a lot of New Zealanders actually see an urban lifestyle as not being conducive to kids. And in fact, it is. You know, there's an amazing amount of things that you can do in the city as a child, and in fact, you know, safety for children inside a city is actually really good as well. I mean, you know, lots of people around means that it's a lot easier to be safe.
Yes, and that's why it's good for seniors, and that's why we need choice for seniors to stay living in their neighbourhoods. That ageing in place is a key part of a positive ageing strategy at the government level. It just needs to be translated into the council environment, and that's a big challenge because, as we were talking earlier before we came on here, seniors are invisible. They are not top of the list in terms of policy priorities, and as a result, it's hands off and, oh, well, you'll pop off to a retirement village, won't you? That's the thinking that goes on right from the highest level. And it's not like the council has a responsibility around this, but we're going to close now. Thank you for being with us. Bye.
Thank you.
get together with Senior Focus next Sunday at 5:25 p.m. on Planet FM 104.6, or listen online at any time at planetaudio.org.nz/Senior Focus. And do note, Senior Focus is one word.